Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The View From Here. I'm co-host Jeff Milchin.
Along with Steve Kirkhoff.
And we're joined today by Pamela Chang. Pamela works helping nonprofit leaders and their organizations to inspire vision and align action. She cut her teeth as an organizer and leader in the environmental justice movement of the 90s and aligns people from diverse backgrounds and experiences toward shared purpose. In addition to her own consulting company, Pamela is a leadership trainer and coach with the Rockwood Leadership Institute. Pamela also puts in time working on her ranch outside of Bozeman, Montana, repairing barbed wire fences and moving cattle on horseback with her husband and children. They strive to sequester carbon in the soil by resuscitating farm and grasslands through intensive grazing management practices. Thanks for joining us today, Pamela.
Thank you. It's great to be with you both.
Nice to see you, Pamela. Mm.
So our goal today is to tap Pamela's experience organizing and making change in the world and overcoming some of the challenges that many people find today and some of the things you hear often about people feeling overwhelmed or powerless and not knowing what steps to take. So we hope to come away with some good ideas through the discussion here to share with everyone. And I'd like to start off, Pamela, by just getting a little bit of a sense of your background and what's some of the first advocacy work that you recall doing and what led you there and what were some of the things that propelled you forward from that?
Well, it's a fun question because it mainly rolls back the tape, right? The memory tape. You know, one of my first memories of organizing was when I was a college student at UC Berkeley. And ironically, it was around the Big Greens initiative in California. So this was in around 1990 to save, you know, old growth trees. And at that time, if you might vaguely recall, or those who may recall or read about, you know, this was the era like where, you know, indicator species like the spotted owl could be used as a leverage for environmentalists to say, hey, you know, if you cut down these old growth trees, these redwoods, the spotted owls and what they represent for an ecosystem will come under demise. So ironically, I got involved in a more traditional environmental activism and experienced some really awful things, actually, that I said, wait, this is not for me, this is not who I am, and then I pivoted.
What do you mean when you say that you experienced awful things? Was it within the organization or did it come from the outside?
It was within the organizations, both on campus and off campus. So, you know, we had a Greens Club. At that time, it was sort of the emergence of the Greens. Before it was even in some ways it was a party in Germany, but also just sort of the concept, right? The concept of equity by gender and all the good things that the pillar stood up for. Well, on the club on campus, it was run by white men, young men, and here I was like one woman of color. And just sort of the ways in which that they treated me unconsciously, they weren't consciously trying to be malicious or off-putting, but it really woke me up to the disconnect between who else had a stake in the interests of the environment. And so between that and then, you know, an initiative campaign, you know, go out and get your signatures and talk to people. And how do you do that? How do you prepare people? How do you talk to people who don't look like you? What do you do when you do talk to people who look or might connect with you? Just various interactions that revealed to me not a whole person and holistic perspective around fundamentally what are we trying to make happen in this place, in this, as a snapshot of a future of democracy, right? I know it's kind of loaded there, but maybe we'll get into it. So it wasn't until later, not much later, that I stumbled across this burgeoning grassroots environmental justice movement. And from there, that's where I found home.
So what were some of the specific issues when you talk about environmental justice that you were working on, and was this still in the Bay Area?
It was through Bay Area and throughout California and frankly the country. So myself and other students on campus, we were just hungry for information. You know, this is, remember, before the internet. And so we're grabbing newspapers from local community organizations in Albuquerque, New Mexico. We're grabbing from periodicals from the National Law Journal. And, you know, we're grabbing from information from wherever we could find it. And we were noticing both nationally stories being told from local communities, a pattern of low-income communities and communities of color organizing themselves to combat forms of environmental racism, which was not fully a term that had been coined at that point in time in 1990-91 in a broad scale way. So locally in Richmond, California, we had, you know, African American, Latino, and Laotian refugee populations living near a large oil refinery, the Chevron oil refinery, and 350 other toxic industries, right, who suffered all kinds of respiratory ailments and other kinds of health conditions due to exposure to the toxic pollution they were living, playing, going to school, working around. So whether it was that or Korean women electronics assemblers in Silicon Valley who were exposed to glycol ethers assembling computer chips and having high miscarriage rates and other kinds of reproductive harm. So those local examples of everyday people who I felt like I could relate to were organizing themselves to say, this is not okay. And I immediately threw myself in to say, how do I use my education in college to put it towards these grassroots efforts for systemic change?
Well, just listening to what you've been saying, Pamela, I'm wondering about how organizations that seek to create some kind of social change, economic change, whatever it might be, it seems that do the structures of these organizations, are they as healthy as the issues that they're working on? Because you said that when you were in school and you were the sole woman of color, and then things did not turn out so well, you left that organization somewhat with a bad taste in your mouth. And this was a group of people who wanted to save these like megafauna species in the environment, versus going to a community where people were already sort of being aroused and trying to make changes for themselves. You found yourself in a much more congenial environment for doing positive work. So I guess my question is, are organizations somehow more fruitful and positive when they're closer to the community and less issue driven, or not?
I love that question. I don't know that just because an organization may be issue driven, that it would lead itself by design to leave people out. I certainly have seen multi-issue organizations come upon their challenges of how do we make all people feel included, involved, empowered, feel agency, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think that the symptoms of the fractures that organizations, particularly, let's just talk about organizations committed towards social action, right? Just put the slice on that. Some of the pitfalls that I've experienced and seen around when organizations hit those fractures have a lot to do with simple things like, how do we actually want to organize ourselves? Like, how do we want to function? What is our core purpose? Like, why do we exist as an organization? Oftentimes, organizations might form because of they're ignited by something that has occurred, right? An oil refinery explosion occurs, and an organization or a coalition might be born to address the misdeeds at the oil refinery. But beyond that fight, why do they exist once that fight is over?
But they want to keep existing, because now they know each other, now they've had a good experience, they've had some success perhaps, and so they want to start addressing other issues in their neighborhood or their immediate environment, and so maybe they want to keep going. But then you're saying they have this existential question as to their purpose and as to who or how many of the who's get to run the show. And is that what you're talking about?
Yeah. That's partly it. And how well did people experience the journey of the fight? right?
Mm-hmm.
I know, first and foremost, look, I got into social action because I wanted us to win, because we are the underdogs. I think, like, most of us get in here because we feel empathic or directly experience that notion of the underdog. Like, this is not right. The balance of power is not working in the favor of the masses, okay? And so what do we do to really evolve the human experiment of this thing called a democracy, right? And how do we try to create it in our organization?
Well, and also, if I may, how about this thing called justice, right?
Yeah. Well, here's another side to it. If we had, what would it be like if we didn't have to fight for justice? A lot of us can't even answer that. What would it be like if we didn't have to fight for equity? It's like we haven't experienced that world.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah.
But what I meant was when you talked about that first organization as a student,
mm-hmm,
having a somewhat less than savory outcome for you, right? It caused you to change your mind,
sure,
and take a different direction. So there could have been one way of saying what happened there. Maybe you can modify this, would be that there wasn't justice within the organization, but the organization wanted justice for the trees, justice for the ecosystem, justice for Mother Earth, whatever it might be, right? So how do you ensure that the organization that you create is also a just organization?
Yeah. Well, so ironically, this is why the last, oh gosh, how many years now? Maybe 13 years have been really, or more than that. I've pivoted from working directly with organizations on the ground or in the trenches organizing myself to supporting organizations and leaders in how do you create the cultures necessary and the supporting structures and form, organizational forms, to actually live and express the harmony which you're desiring to create in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a hard endeavor, especially in these times.
Yeah.
Right? If anything, the sad truth is, Steve and Jeff, I see in many organizations that are even highly successful across the country right now, I see a certain degree of groups eating themselves up. And I'm not a psychologist or a social scientist.
Don't let that stop you,
yeah,
please.
Yeah, but you know, there's something to be said of when the air is so thick around you, around that oppressive environment, you start believing it and you start repeating it. You internalize it and spit it back out on those that are beloved among you.
So Pamela, when you say eating themselves up, I'm not sure everyone would grasp what you're talking about if they haven't been involved in, you know, the organizing world. Could you get into that a little?
I mean, I see the pitfalls of, you know, groups, to Steve's point around the injustice or lack of equity or lack of inclusion or any kind of wrong manifesting itself inside organizations. That happens. And that's, in a way, kind of just normal. Guess what? How many people does it take to make a team?
At least two.
There you go.
Right.
And how many times in a team are you ever going to have a moment of difference or difficulty?
This is my wedding anniversary. So I'd say never. We're always in perfect harmony.
Right? We feel it in the home life. We feel it in our attempts, to create these new institutions, these new forms, however formal or informal. We're going to have sandpaper moments, is what I like to call it, right? Mm-hmm. Or when our elbows are clashing. But how do we handle that? How do we work through our differences? How do we learn how to raise and resolve issues positively and productively? And so what I realized along the way is I was just forming organizations, coalitions, alliances, fighting for campaigns, corporate accountability, government accountability campaigns at a local to national scale. Nobody taught me, nobody taught us how to work through the stuff when we would have our breakdowns with,
mm-hmm,
each other. And so everything became, mm-hmm, my idea versus your idea. And whoever dukes it out the best wins.
Mm-hmm.
But somehow that's not getting us at a speed and a pace necessary to align and act together. People think if you just make a long agenda, come and meet, hammer it out, good, done, go home, you're done. But if you break relationships along the way, or if you don't feel you can say what you need to say because you might rock the boat, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then nothing is really there. There are five core elements to building durable teams that can actually outperform. And anybody who's been part of a sports team or a musical ensemble or orchestra, any kind of endeavor together, right, would probably say, yeah, this is pretty much it. And as far as I know, there are these five things. One, why do you exist? That purpose question, as a group, right? Even if you're a short-term team, just what's your purpose and what's your charge? Like, what are we here to do? Like, before every meeting, activity, retreat, or whatever I'm doing with a group of people in a system, I have them create a design team. Does it give me five people from across your system? They're going to be representatives of that organizational system. We're going to work together and design for a whole. And the first thing I sit them down to understand is, here is our charge. And we go over it. So they're not coming with their own five individual ideas, but five people coming together to really tap the whole of this organization and design for the whole in mind. Right, so clarity of purpose. Clarity of what are our strategic priorities or goals? What is it that we're here, like, gonna pay attention to? We can't do everything. What are the one, two, three, or four things we're here to pay attention to? How are we gonna organize ourselves in terms of the processes?
Is this number three now?
Number three. What kinds of meetings? How often? When do we handle just the mundane, the logistics, the tactical stuff? When do we need to grapple with some of, like, the meaty strategic questions? Not everything at all meetings, because some meetings, you only got 30 minutes or 15, right? So be clear about where you're going to handle what issues when. Mm-hmm. Fourth, clarity of roles. What's my job in relation to this team? Your job, right?
Mm-hmm.
So a division of labor. And I forgot, part of processes, this is super important. This is where a lot of breakdown happens. In addition to, like, how are we going to meet? How do we decide things? This is where a lot of groups conflate power with decision making, and it's not the same.
I'm imagining a meeting with a group who has asked you to come and have this meeting with the group because the group knows that it's stumbling. And even the question of, like, how do you run the meeting becomes questionable. Like, uh-huh. Who's in charge? Wait, why does she... What is he doing? You know what I'm saying? I can see it just being like chaos in a large family or something.
Totally, right? Like, I've been part of super, super collective types to highly structured types of organizations. It can still be organized.
So there's not one more favorable end of the spectrum to be reside on, from the collectivist to the hierarchical.
No.
Whatever works for the group works for the group.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And to be clear, hierarchy is not necessarily bad. And who's to say we call it hierarchy? It's called a division of labor.
Mm-hmm.
Like, in a paid organizational setting, there's value in, like, some people being responsible for thinking about everything from a 35,000 elevation view versus some folks who are thinking about, all right, we got to deliver this program over the next month.
Mm-hmm.
And I think among organizations, there's sort of this story we tell ourselves these days that, well, hierarchy equals bad. Actually, let's get underneath it. What's the breakdown here? And let's not pile on.
Mm-hmm.
So the groups tend to diagnose wrong what's actually going on when they do have breakdowns. So there are these four things, right? Purpose, priorities, processes, roles, and then the last one and most important and foundational one is our community, a sense of community and relationships, right? So all this is like the fundamental principle. All work gets done through relationships. Wait a minute. I signed up because I wanted to stop coal trains going through my community. Okay. Are you going to handle that by yourself?
Right.
And we have all been in moments, I know I've been, where I'm just so passionate and energized around a particular thing and I want to get it done. But hold on a second. All work gets done through relationships. I'm not going to be able to accomplish that thing by myself. Name one thing you can do in terms of work getting done that you can do on your own.
that certainly resonates with me. I spent almost 19 years directing a national nonprofit, the American Independent Business Alliance, that carried out its work largely through helping community-based organizations around the country.
Mm.
And always, if we were coming in doing a workshop of any kind, would really encourage activities to strengthen the social relationships and not just have everything be business meetings. And that certainly,
yes,
you know, the organizations that were most effective definitely had those strong personal connections. It wasn't just about who was really well organized in the traditional sense and mm-hmm. who had the smartest people in the room, but the people who liked being around each other, or at least if, even if not everybody liked each other, they had a good understanding of each other.
That's so great. That's a gift. It's a tall order, right? Like that is one of my golden rules. Whenever I am, whether it was helping a group of Mexican farm workers in Central Valley fight a private prison from being developed back in the 90s, to working with a statewide grassroots power building organization that's moving their economy from coal to something different, to a just transition, right? It's my golden rule is to leave the quality of the relationships better than I find it. Now, I can't control that, but it's my job, and I think it's all of our jobs, really, to lay the stones on the ground so that we can step together across this muddy path and make it across, right? Like, how are we going to, how we design, how we set up conversations matter as much as the content of the conversation. And I've learned from my own mistakes and successes, like, the context matters as much as the content.
All right.
Everything you're saying is making me thoughtful, and maybe to the point where I can't even come up with a good follow-up question, but I'm thinking about how, as an individual, in my own bits of time in political action, how I came to the arena. I came to the arena of, like, getting involved locally because of anger. That can't happen. I want to stop that. So I came to that, and then I got into elected politics where I didn't have to do all this sort of business. But what strikes me is that what you're telling me about organizing, activism, community togetherness around social and political action is that it's way more complicated than just having a fire in the belly about a particular issue. And no matter how clear you are about what you want, that's just the tip of the iceberg, and what we need to do when we come together is pay attention to these five things, particularly relationships. So I would like to ask you, like, what's the most memorable, in the positive sense, what's like the most memorable sort of community action, social action that you've been involved with that sort of embodies for us a kind of a positive example of, like, they came together from their individual reasons, they joined, they talked, they worked together, they processed together, and they were successful.
There are many in some ways. I can think of, but you know why the long pause here is...
Please explain it, because I was getting anxious.
Yeah. Is that these things don't happen in a very clean and tidy beginning and a very clean and tidy end. So what I noticed when you asked the question was sort of like a running tape of all these different situations I've been in as a background organizer for, or what have you. It took a lot to get to where we got, right? So let me try to think of one thing. A very specific local example was in 1999 in Richmond, California, when I was a staff organizer at the Asian Pacific Environmental Network. It is still in existence, and if you Google APEN4, the number 4, EJ.org, you'll find out the amazing things they are doing at a statewide level around...
4.
And so it's APEN, APEN,
mm-hmm.
the number 4,
mm-hmm.
EJ.org.
EJ.org.
Right.
Happen4EJ.org.
Yep, exactly. So it was 1999, and Chevron had yet another big explosion at their oil refinery. Okay. And Richmond, California is in the Bay Area. It's sort of this armpit that nobody ever knows about. You know, it's just north of Berkeley and just east of Marin County, okay? The affluent community. And so it had a big explosion at the oil refinery. It sent 20,000 people to area hospitals.
Jeez.
And that's pretty massive.
20,000
yes.
people.
Like how the hospital.
For similar symptoms or just.
All kinds of.
All kinds
mostly
of stuff.
Respiratory and skin reactions, right? We had been in the community organizing around various issues, had a strong youth leadership program there. And we seized the opportunity of, here is a crisis. Now, this is an organizer's gift, is how do you take a crisis and turn it to an opportunity, right? So who were some of the directly impacted people? Well, during the day, working hours, the people who are there are either children in school or elders at home. Right, and so because we had been working with the Laotian refugee population in Richmond, these were seniors, pre-literate Laotian elders, right, who were among four or five different distinct tribal backgrounds, Lao, Khmu, Mien, Hmong, Taidam, right, who spoke different language sets, not necessarily a written language. So elders at home, the sirens go off, the Chevron refinery has explosion, and elders don't know what to do when you hear this siren. They're at home taking care of young children who are maybe in school or not school age. They hear the sirens, they don't know what to do. Do you run outside? Think, if you're from a refugee experience and you hear sirens, what's the first association you might have?
They're coming for me.
It takes you back to the refugee camps mm-hmm. with bombs.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a re-traumatization of a community, and a community who hasn't been properly informed or educated. When the sirens go off, that means shelter in place. Close the windows, close your doors, be inside. Maybe your indoor air will be better than what's going on in the outdoor air because we've just had a major chemical explosion. So we quickly called for a community meeting, and we were pulled together as many folks between our staff and elders and adults and youth in the community who could speak all the different language sets and say, hey, what's happening? What are you experiencing? And we quickly crafted together among elders and young teenage and preteen girls a campaign to get that county, Contra Costa County, to install a multilingual emergency warning system. To be clear, Chevron was the entity that did the misdeed. But we knew the county had a responsibility to protect its citizens, its residents. And so it was through our inquiry with our members and other community members, what were people experiencing, what would we do about it? And so here was a first step as a very small grassroots organization with very little influence over a large multinational corporation or the government to say, what could we fight for that would be powerful, meaningful, would bring about some change, and would help us develop leadership and recruit more members to be involved. It was a long fight. And we ultimately got the county to not only approve, but to put money with it mm-hmm. to implement one of the nation's first multilingual emergency warning systems. So
that's what you wanted, right?
And that's what we got.
And that's what you got. And so the question, I guess, is that sounds like a very successful organizing movement and moment. Yeah. But was it just a moment or did that?
It kept on building from there. So now, 25 or more years later, APEN in Richmond is generating huge gains. Richmond City Council has historically been bought by Chevron.
Mm-hmm.
And they've pretty much transformed the makeup of the local political leadership at the city level and beyond. But that's only one way in which power is revealed in your elected leadership. The fact that there's even a continuing standing membership and organization that is taking a stand around clean air, clean water, and democracy from voices of people you wouldn't typically hear from, right? Mm-hmm. That's taking a stand for what can be possible. So we knew that this wasn't going to end exposure to environmental harm, but it was a first step to build mm-hmm. power and continue building a platform from there, which has led to state right. policy change. So that was...
Right. Well, kind of the... Tell me, was part of the idea simply that you build power and confidence in an organization by making sure your first goal is something achievable and then building on from there?
Yeah. And this was a big goal for us because it wasn't like we even started organizing for stop signs mm-hmm. in our communities. There's this old joke in community organizing circles. You know, you organize neighborhood residents for stop signs so cars don't go by so quick so kids don't get hurt, right? Like, that's easy win, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody wants public safety. We didn't even start at that level. We went at a pretty big leap. Mm-hmm. And mind you, to have pre-literate elders who fought in the Vietnam War walk up the steps of the county building an hour away from where where they live and speak in front of a microphone and actually look into the eyes of an elected official was a huge transformative right. experience for our elder member leaders and the youth. Because culturally, they were not accustomed to looking people in the eye. Secondly, they did not grow up in a political or cultural system where you can raise a concern. And this was an interesting layer. When we first organized, you know who some of our first people, who the first people said, you will never win, were the educated Laotians, the adults who had jobs, who were who could speak English and their Laotian language, and said, nobody's going to listen to a bunch of old people and kids.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm.
And so we just said, fine, we'll keep moving.
Thank you for your input.
I want to take a moment to remind everyone that you're listening to KGVM 95.9 FM in Bozeman and streaming online at kgvm.org. You're listening to The View from Here, and our guest on this edition is Pamela Chang. So, Pamela, I was wondering if you might have a sense from your experience bringing people into community organizing for the first time, who often, I imagine, don't have a track record of activism, who may feel powerless in many senses. That seems to be, as mentioned at the top of the show, something a lot of people feel today, especially at the national level. Any insights from your experience for someone who, let me take one example here, the imprisonment of families and even children at the Mexican border, people who are upset about that going on and being done by our federal government. Here, for example, here in Montana, I don't even know if there's an organization that's directly addressing that. How do you start people on the road of finding ways to plug in and become effective?
I feel this myself, right? Like, where do I put myself in, right? What local or other kinds of entities do I put my time or energy or resources into, in addition to the time I spend with them in my work days, right? I think, one thing we might need to think about is some distinctions, right? I come from the school of organizing where we always ask the question of, who's directly impacted? Who benefits and who bears the burden relative to the particular problem or issue? Now, on some levels, when you look at, back when we were organizing environmental justice, everybody deserves the right to clean air, clean land, clean water, right? Everybody deserves the right to live, work, and play in a clean and healthy environment. Overall, we don't want to send our oil refinery south of the border to Mexico. That's not environmental justice. That's just back in the day we called it NIMBY, not in my backyard, right?
People still use that today.
Yeah, they still do it. Wow. Okay.
yeah, they still say it and they still do it.
And they still do it.
Even if they don't say it, they do it.
Yeah, displacing a problem is not a solution. Okay. But when you really get to a deeper and more sophisticated analysis, it's who benefits and who bears the burden? Who's directly impacted? And I think when we start to examine that question, your example of the imprisonment of Mexicans and Central Americans fleeing their home country attempting to cross the U.S.-Mexico border to a life of safety. You know, I am not directly impacted by that experience, me as who I am here. Now, if I'm a Latina or Latinx person in Montana, I may not be directly impacted, but I might be a secondarily impacted because somebody might see me and make some assessments and judgments, as has been the case around two Spanish-speaking women in Havre who were confronted, right, by a border agent. I mean, that was totally just because they were speaking Spanish in a store, and this off-duty border agent immediately started questioning them and brought them in. It was over the top. But the issue at the local level around people coming to and fleeing the border, I think from an organizer mind, okay, these are the people directly impacted. Who are the organizations who are trying to work with them or access them? Now, this is a population that we can't even access to directly organize, to liberate, to speak for themselves. That's a first order problem from an organizer's mindset, right? So, mm-hmm. Okay, if we don't have a way to access them, to be able to liberate them, to speak for themselves and organize for collective action and some kind of change, then what can we do as innocent bystanders, observers? What could we do that would be a supportive process or effort? If we roll back the tape, when Trump announced his ban on immigrants coming into the country from certain Middle Eastern countries, right? Mm-hmm. And there was a floodgate of people to the airports in New York. There were people who said, we are going to the airports to allow our families who are coming in to come in safely. There was a whole organized, organic mobilization, right, to say, we will not accept this ban. Let these people who have bought their tickets get off the planes and come in. So sometimes, this is a little bit... sometimes we need to mobilize to act, but that is in of itself not organizing. So at best, we either create some kind of loose or formal organization to be ready to act, ready to pounce, whether it's for a proactive goal that we want or to respond to protect, and or we align with entities closer to the directly impacted population so we can be a pipeline source of support, whatever that may be. But we've got to organize ourselves in some way where we're ready. Now remember those five things I said? For groups to be effective, why do we exist? What are our meetings processes and our decision-making processes, our priorities, our roles, and how strong is our relationship? We've got to have those things intact so that we're ready to, if it's a mobilization or if it's a long campaign that we need to like organize on that includes mobilization among other tactics, that we've got to understand how are we going to relate to the people who really will suffer the most.
I have a question for you, which is not apropos of anything you just said, but it is on the topic. Let's imagine a person living in a place and this person really has a profound feeling of injustice about a particular thing happening in the environment. Doesn't really matter at the moment whether it's because of a political action by a local leader or an action taken by a large corporation or just something that's wrong with the fabric of life, and this person's chomping at the bit, wanting to do something about it, but never does. It's like a soldier waiting for the captain to come along. Right. It's like someone who's ready to act but doesn't know how to organize, doesn't know how to like make phone calls, get people in a room, doesn't know what the first step is to do to make a positive change, but so desires the change. And What do you do? Because I imagine at this moment that there are lots of people who might be listening to this program who feel that way. Mm-hmm. He or she or they have this thing in mind, and it doesn't stop. They dream about it. They think about it the next day over and over and over, et cetera, et cetera. But they feel disempowered. They don't know where to start.
Yeah.
What do you say to people, just the average citizen who has all these potential feelings, this and the potential to act, the potential to organize? What What do you say to people who feel like that but are so frustrated and don't do anything?
It'd be a little tongue-in-cheek, but first is, can you make a cup of coffee or a cup of tea? And can you make more than one? Humans, you know, we're mammals. We're meant to stick together. Yeah, there are certain mammal species that go off on their own, but they ultimately come back, right? And so to this individual who has this yearning but doesn't know where to begin, start a conversation with wherever you feel you have the closest reach. If it's let's think of a hypothetical person in some industry or work. I mean, let's create an example.
Somebody who's like a low-level tech in Google.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
And she has a problem with something in the organization.
Mm-hmm.
And she feels that it affects more than just her.
Mm-hmm.
And that it's wrong.
Right. In her place of work, and she wants to change the conditions in her place of work or in society or both.
Or even just like having an insight into how the company works and how it relates to the rest of the world. Whatever. It could be within the organization or it could be the organization's impact on the world.
Right. What does she want to be different?
So have a clear sense of purpose, which is step one in your five core elements.
Well, that's like in the context of when you're working with people. But I think for an individual, in because all work happens through relationships. If I'm an individual in a community or a place of work or circumstance where I'm not happy with how things are and I want it to be different, a first question is, what do you want to be different? And I would ask it in a two-way thing. What do I want to be different in the environment around me? And I'm scaling that to whatever that is. The environment might be my workplace. The environment might be community. It might be nation. It might be state, right? What do I want to be different that I'm not satisfied with? I'm not content with. I'm uncomfortable with. Like, it doesn't feel right. It doesn't feel just, or whatever it is, right?
Mm-hmm.
What do I want to be different? How do I want to be different? So this is where the version of me in the 21st century as opposed to the version of me in the 20th century. In the 20th century, I was just trained, like, what do I want to be different in the world? But I wasn't prepared to ask myself, well, how am I going to be different? How am I willing to be changed? And that's the fundamental thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
How am I willing to be changed? Because the other side of it is horrible. We've had the experience where we come upon... Maybe some of us have been one of those people where somebody is so passionate about what the injustice or what's wrong that they're so righteous upon us that I feel completely disinterested.
Right.
That's actually worse. I'm really offended when people approach me in that kind of righteous tone. Mm-hmm. That is not inspiring. The number, when you talk about organizing, it is a leadership ethos, a leadership mind space. And the principles of leadership are fundamentally around inspire and enroll people towards change. Now, I am not going to be effective if I'm just spewing at you, talking at you with all these things. We've all had it done to us. And dare I say, I have certainly done it to others.
So what's my purpose? And also, when I make tea for two, and I get someone who has a sympathetic ear, who might share my sense of injustice, who might join up with me, then I need to have some humility about the way in which I discuss the situation with this person, right?
Yeah.
As opposed to just talking the woe is me. And how evil this organization is and how oppressed I am by the others.
Right.
That's what you're saying is a big turnoff.
Yeah. I mean, to be clear, there are times when we need to vent. And my guidance to people is, all right, I got to vent for 5 minutes. Cool. Because venting is not enough. What do you want to do about it?
Mm-hmm.
Because you know how it is. We've been employees, and we've been employers, right? And some of us, in some way, right? Hey, you pay a babysitter. That's an employer. And so, when we feel like the woe is me, I want to find somebody who's going to agree and support the thing I'm upset about. but that's not necessarily going to move me to be different and create something different. So the first question is, what do I want to be different? Either in a relationship, in an issue, whatever scale, how do I want to be different?
Let's stay off the record for a second. So let's say you're a Walmart worker, mm-hmm. right? You work in appliances, and mm-hmm. you're just sick of it. You're sick of your wage. You're sick of your low hours. You're sick of the fact that you can't make ends meet. It's hard for you to find another job elsewhere. You'd really love to have like some union organization. Somebody in the union talk to you, as a matter of fact. You'd like to have that person come in. You don't know the first thing about anything. You just want that to happen. So you're saying, well, what are you prepared to change in your life? So if mm-hmm. you do get union reps and they do get a 40-hour work week and you do get, you know, medical benefits and the pension copay from Walmart, you have to give something for that.
Oh,
do you see what I'm saying? But that's how I took what your comment was.
Got it.
Like, how are you prepared to change?
Ah.
Because you are militating for more rights in the workplace and better compensation mm-hmm. and better whatever. So what are you prepared to do? When your status changes, are you prepared to change in yourself as a worker? Is mm-hmm. that sort of
that
what you were saying?
That wasn't what I meant.
Okay.
So when I mean, how am I willing to change? Or how do I want to be different? Okay. So when faced with a situation, I want something to be different. What do you want what do you want to be different? So it's like a, how am I wanting to be different over the course of making that same difference in the world? That's a little bit of the point underneath Gandhi's famous and very well used statement, be the change you wish to see in the world. To a low wage worker, like, what do you mean by that? How do I want to be different? I'm underpaid, undervalued, not with any financial security. My message in that isn't about you got to give something up. Is how are you going to be willing to be changed, be different in a fight to change the collective economic condition in your workplace? It's, for example, a group of workers organizing for workers' rights.
Mm-hmm. This seems to be like a theme, although we haven't said it explicitly, mm-hmm. but it seems to be a theme about self and group. Everybody comes to the group because they have in themselves a grievance, and these people might actually know what I'm talking about, right? So you go to the group because you want a change. And then you sit there with your arms crossed for a while, observing, listening, skeptically, trying to find out whether or not there's going to be a mesh there. And that, what I hear you saying is that you're never going to find a group that's a mirror reflection of what you want. Every group is going to find out that all of them together have really legitimate stakes that are different.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow a blending of those, which means an acquiescence of the self to the group, to some extent, it's going to have to happen, right? Accommodations
yes.
have to be made. So what are you going to give up? How are you going to be that change? You're going to be a part of a change that isn't what you originally thought in your single conscious mind. You
Correct.
Know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
And for some people, that might be a deal breaker. Like, I'm not going back there.
Well,
they just wanted to talk about, I came there to talk about X, yeah. and they started talking about Y, so I'm not going to go back there.
Yeah.
Do you find that happening?
I find that. And interestingly enough, I find that most with people who have, the higher up you go in people's education, ironically, I see mm-hmm. this in a most difficult way. So I work with people with PhDs in those kinds of organizational systems who think they know everything.
Mm-hmm.
And literally, if it's not the way they see it, it's not the way to be done on any kind of change, right? Say inside a workplace or a system. I have in my life experience.
It's really hard to teach people who already know.
Well, there is a famous person called who's unfortunately passed on, Chris Argyris, who was very much a leader in the organizational and human behavioral realm. And he had this article, Teaching Smart People to Learn.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly it. And you see it among corporate executives too, right? They think they know it all and they aren't.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not just corporate executives. It's within all of us,
could
right?
Could be anyone.
Yeah. what I have found time and again when...
Could be about the three-egg omelet. No, I don't do it that way. No, you have to put a teaspoon of water in there. No, I will not do that.
I didn't know about the water.
No, but I mean, yeah. This idea that teaching someone who thinks that he or she or they know is fraught with peril, whereas teaching someone who comes to you saying, I have a passion, I don't know what I'm doing.
Well, I think for people who are more educated, who have economic security, social security, and I don't mean the retirement checks, but security in the way they can move through society, more so than others. The more of that they have, I think in some ways the more difficult this question is of how do I get involved? Unless they have real people in their lives who are of different economic status, different social status, different realities that gives them an injection of this is what real life is about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're the truck driver,
mm-hmm.
if you're related to the welder who can fix your truck, if you're connected to the farm worker who plants and harvests the foods you eat. The more we become, and Bozeman, Montana, has an aspect of this bubble.
You mean people comfortably insulated from others?
Yeah.
Because whenever we need something, we can afford to pay to have it done.
Yeah. That's right. Service it.
Mm-hmm.
It even starts at that basic level. Who am I relating with? So that question of how am I willing to be changed? How will I be changed? Am I even open to change? Am I open to learning what I don't know and not just what I read off of my favorite periodicals or such?
Obviously, you're working with a lot of groups that are facing big challenges, and I imagine keeping up hope and morale is a challenge at times. And it seems like in the past several months, I've had more conversations than any other time in my life with people who feel a level of hopelessness and despair. You have any thoughts about how you go about countering that? You know, not just brushing it aside, but acknowledging the depth of challenges and problems and figuring out how to accept and move forward.
Mm-hmm. Despair is somehow not in my way of being. So in a way I feel like inadequate to answer that because I literally don't understand despair. And that's me coming from, I'm first generation from war survival. So I was raised by a single mother who survived war.
And where was this?
This was in San Francisco, in the San Francisco Bay Area. My mother was an immigrant. Her mother country was China. And she was a young child when the Japanese invaded China, and there were, it was a time of famine, it was a time of war, it was a time of death, loss, separation, just one big dramatic event to another that led to all kinds of trauma, and I don't use that word lightly. So as somebody who is born and raised from somebody who has survived a lot in her survival, she's 87, my mother, and to be an immigrant woman and a single mom, that's like a deal too, all of its own, right? She has always been in the realm of possibility, a mind space of possibility. And so by birthright, I have that. And I think when we fall to despair, we have forgotten that lineage, of which we all have. We are all survivors of the ancestors, the people before us, who gave up something to gain something for a future generation they weren't going to necessarily know, right? And so that kind of lineage mindset lives very strong in who I am. And I think for people who have lost their ways in that, there's something fun about genealogy. The stories that come up, whether or not it's part of the family history we don't really want to accept, but we all have it. I happen to be closer to it. And some of our lineage can also be through, like I claim a lineage around my political analysis and organizing, right? The people who trained me into the kind of strategic organizing, they are people who overcame very difficult times, you know, in the Black Power movement, in the American Indian movement, the Chicano movement, the Asian American movement, the third wave feminism movement, like mm-hmm. those individuals who fought in times when the FBI had COINTELPRO. I mean, some of us have read about that. Some of us don't even know about it, right? Like, they didn't have time to despair. And so when we can identify with a lineage, it helps us put ourselves into perspective. That what we're experiencing now, a version of it has occurred before, maybe differently, and we have surpassed it. And what do we learn in this moment that we need to carry forward for the next, right? So it's sort of like, you know, when we talk about the long arc of justice, this is some of what we mean. Maybe one more thought to this question of what to do with despair. In times like these, the relevance of community and being in community is so important, right? You don't have to have an organization to do that. You don't have to have all those five mm-hmm. things. But even being in community where you can create moments of celebration, where you can experience joy, that even though that in these dark times, we can still celebrate, we can be human, we can experience love, we can experience resilience. That's actually why, and you know me, Jeff, in, you know, every year around New Year's Eve or New Year's Day, I organize a big winter party on the ranch, mm-hmm. right? It's either sledding or skating or cross-country skiing. I cook a pot of chili, I put on a hot cider, and people bring other snacks to share, and we just spend the afternoon, you know, in reverie in the cold elements. We need that. That is not to say, oh, we should not do something about the problems in the world, you know? It's both and. It's
absolutely.
Like we need those moments to remember that we are still whole and complete, because nobody can take that from us. And especially those of us who have or can influence young people around us, whether or not we have children of our own, but our presence around young people to say, yes, joy and celebration and reverie is important, because you know what? The thing we need to hold on to is our imagination. Our imagination and our ability to dream a different future. That is what is going to carry us forward. When we can stay in that realm of imagination, which is rooted in the origins of play and mistakes and reverie mm-hmm. and joy, then we can start figuring out in creative ways, not just by ourselves, but together, because we're being community, what could be possible. And that's when, how many times conversations in settings like that have led to
right.
magnificent organizing yeah. efforts, right? Yeah. You've got some, I'm great. Sure.
I'm glad you talked about the idea of joy, too, because certainly my experience, the groups that I've found to be most effective, if I show up for an event with them, there's typically a lot of laughter and a lot of warmth, and people are having a good time. It's not that they're not serious, but those groups definitely seem to be accomplishing a whole lot more than one where, you know, if I walk into the room and it's kind of somber and businesslike and there's not much levity, that immediately makes me concerned when I come across a group like that. So thanks for bringing that up.
Yeah, thank you for letting me connect to something that's so foundational.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. You've been listening to The View from Here with our guest for this edition, Pamela Chang. And if you go to kgvm.org and the community section where our show The View from Here is listed, we'll have a website link to learn more about Pamela and a couple of the other things mentioned on the show today. So thanks for joining us. And again, you're listening to KGVM 95.9 FM in Bozeman.